This is Perspectives with Barry Shanebaum on Faith FM and Hope FM, 94.3 in Kitchener and Woodstock, and on Inspire FM, 105.9 in London, Ontario.
Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in. This is Holocaust Education Week. The Holocaust was a systematic state-sponsored persecution and murder of approximately 6 million Jews by the Nazi regime and its collaborators. In 1933, the Jewish population of Europe stood at over 9 million. By 1945, the Germans and their collaborators killed nearly 2 out of every 3 European Jews as part of the Final Solution. With us today are Shlomit Krieger and John Freund. Shlomit is the editor of Marking Humanity, Stories, Poems, and Essays by Holocaust Survivors. John Freund is one of the 46 survivors featured in the book. John Freund was born in 1930 to a middle-class Jewish family in Czechoslovakia. In 1933, the Nazis sent his family to a camp in Birkenau, Poland. When he returned to his hometown in 1945, only one aunt was alive. John is also the author of 50 Years, Memories of the Birkenau Boys. He has been married for 51 years and has 3 daughters and 10 grandchildren. Shlomit Krieger is a freelance writer and editor. She has a Bachelor of Journalism degree from Ryerson University, and her articles have appeared in many publications. Since the age of 9, she's written her own poetry, songs, and short stories. Shlomit recently received a certificate in expressive arts therapy. She continues to explore how the arts can be used to help people express themselves, become empowered, and heal. Shlomit Krieger and John Freund join us in studio. Good afternoon and welcome to the show.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.
It's great to have you both in studio. Shlomit, how did you come to create the book, Marking Humanity?
My personal connection to the Holocaust is that my grandfather, Kusha Krieger, had fought in the Red Army during the Holocaust while his parents, most siblings, and other relatives were murdered in the Minsk ghetto in Belarus. Also, a couple of years ago, I coordinated the 6th annual creative writing contest for the homeless for a Toronto-based humanitarian organization called Mehafta. This experience was very meaningful and rewarding for me. I got to see how the contest helped to motivate some of the participants to take some positive steps in new directions in their lives, and also it gave them a voice in the community as opposed to being mere statistics. At the end of the contest, I helped to put together a zine with the winning submissions from that year, and I thought it would be interesting to one day collect writings from a different population.
Now you're 28 years old.
Yes, I am.
Now, it's relatively uncommon for someone of your age to be working on anthologies of the Holocaust. How much do you tie that into your grandfather, or just how much to, in a sense, your awareness that we have to bring these stories to life as Holocaust survivors do in time pass on?
Well, the inner strength that my grandfather and the survivors have, it really inspires me. And I actually wanted the book to help celebrate the indomitable spirits of the survivors and also allow them the chance to share with others what came through their hearts and souls during and after the Holocaust.
Shlomit, how difficult was it to put this book together? I mean, there's 46 different people, 46 different stories
right.
in this book.
Yes.
How long did it take you and how difficult was it?
Well, I was collecting submissions from March 2009 to August of that year, and then I started to put everything together for the book. I created a flyer with some details on the purpose of the book and the submission guidelines, and I sent that out to various Holocaust museums, nursing homes, and many of my contacts locally and internationally, and I just wanted people to help spread the word to any survivors or even relatives or survivors for those who've already passed away if they were interested in submitting something.
From the 46 people in your book, how many are locally from Toronto, where you call home, and how many are in parts of Canada, the States, or other parts of the world?
There's 24 from the United States. There's 14 from Ontario, most in Toronto. And there's 3 from England, 2 from Australia, 2 from Israel, and there was 1 from Germany.
How many of them have you met personally? Putting this
I
book
have met about 9 of them from Toronto, but mostly I've been corresponding with them over email or by mail.
Have you made some new lifelong friendships?
I have, yes. Yes, they're wonderful people.
That is good. Is there anything that surprised you or anything that you learned new from putting together this anthology of essays and poems and stories in your book, Marking Humanity?
Yes, I found that the Holocaust survivors, although there's a lot of pain and sadness in their writings, they also still have a lot of compassion for humanity, and they really want to, they have a lot of hope and determination to help to spread a message of peace for all people, and I think that's very important.
What do you feel is the determining factor in listeners today understanding the stories and hearing the stories of Holocaust survivors? Well, some will come out stronger with a sense of humor and appreciation of life. I imagine some of them went downwards in a life of spiraling of anger and hatred. Is that true?
Well, not so much in the ones that I've been in contact with, a lot of them. Actually, it's interesting that they have been able to maybe find some release and healing for their experiences through their writing and through the creation of art and sharing with others what happened and having that voice to be able to share, to continue on their story and have people not forget what happened.
Well, it is very important for we in society to, in time, to forgive injustices. We're now talking the state systemized killing and murder of 6 million Jews plus other minority groups. Did you feel that forgiveness came into play for any of the 46 people to whatever aspect they could forgive the Nazi murderers?
It is very important, yes. They did have to struggle with that. And I know that there are some of them also now who even would say, well, I don't know if I could see myself even going back to Germany, for example, considering what people there had done during the Holocaust. But I think that it's important to also recognize what we can do today to make a difference for people and to move past that and show people also that it's not just about the past and what happened to other people, but it's also still relevant for many communities today. And it's important to learn what we can learn from the past.
You're listening to Shlomit Krieger, the editor of Marking Humanity, Stories, Poems, and Essays by Holocaust Survivors. And sitting right beside Shlomit is John Freund, one of the 46 people in the book. Good afternoon, John. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
It's good to have you here in studio in Kitchener. So, John, open-ended question. Tell us about your journey through those years when your family was sent off to the family camp. Okay, let's say, what is a family camp as opposed to a concentration camp?
Well, first of all, I'll give you a little bit of my background.
Okay.
I come from Czechoslovakia, the western part of Czechoslovakia, which is now the Czech Republic. They created for the Jews there a ghetto called Terezinstadt, which was mostly for the Czech Jews. I spent 18 months there in 1942. We were taken from our homes to that sort called ghetto. It was a town surrounded by walls, and there were about as many as 35,000-40,000 people, Jewish people living there. As my father, the medical doctor, they needed him there for a while, and while we were there, life was more or less bearable. But then in December 1943, we were sent by cattle train to Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is near Poland, near the Czech borders, and that's where the hell started. For a reason of their own, the Germans killed most of the people who came to that camp, were killed in the gas chambers immediately. But as rumors had started going through Europe about the gas chambers, the Germans wanted to say this is all lies. So they put 5,000 people, more or less, into a so-called family camp, which was within the site of the Birkenau gas chambers. And as it happened, I was among the 5,000 in that particular family camp. My family camp, it was a concentration camp. It was part of Birkenau. The only difference was that there were both women, men, and children, or old people, among those people in the so-called family camp.
And John, your family consisted of you, your brother, and your parents. Were there any other siblings?
No, I had a brother, older brother.
And how long did you live in this family camp at Birkenau?
In the family camp, I lived for about 6 months, from December 1943 till July 1944. When the Russian army started to approach that part of the world, the Germans were very anxious to destroy the evidence. So they actually started to destroy the gas chambers. When they started to liquidate the family camp, there may have been about, at that time, maybe 6,000-7,000 people in the family camp. They lined up the stronger men and stronger women, and they shipped those to do work in Germany and factories. Then when they did that, my father and my brother were among those that were among those who were shipped to do work. Then the rest of the camp, everybody knew, and this would have included my mother, my relatives, anybody older, all the children under 16, and we knew that there was only one end to us, and the end was the gas chambers. But then on a particular day, as it happened, was July the 6th, 1944, which happened to be 1 month following my 14th birthday. The authorities said that all the boys, 12 to 16, were to line up, and we were lined up by the infamous Dr. Mengele in the nude, and he looked at each of us and he decided whether they would be strong enough to live a little bit longer or they go to the gas chambers. And at that time, he selected close to 100 boys, mostly 14-year-old boys, and I was among those. And those were among those that were not immediately killed but were sent to a nearby camp.
Now, John, you're the only survivor from your family. What happened to your older brother?
As it happened, I did find out eventually that my father and my brother were on the so-called death march, which they were marching endlessly through fields and roads. And my brother could no longer go on, so he fell behind. My father tried to help him up, and they were both killed, shot to death by the SS men.
When you look at life today, you've had such great losses. Sometimes we hear the phrase, I personally don't care for the phrase, survivor guilt. Have you ever faced survivor guilt, wondering, like, why are you alive and your family is gone?
I give it all to luck because, first of all, I was in the ghetto Terezin for long enough because my father, and then we were shipped to the so-called family camp, and there were of the 5,000 was very small percentage for all those. And then I was among the 100 boys, 14-year-olds, that were selected by Mengele on July the 6th, 1944. So it was luck, 99% luck.
When you made it out of the family camp at Birkenau, what happened next? Where did you go?
We went to the neighboring camp, the so-called men's camp, which was still in Birkenau. It was perhaps only 100 or 200 meters away from the family camp. And there we performed duties such as instead of horses, we were pulling wagons and loading them with sand or lumber. So that was what the boys did. We were carrying business. We were working, from early morning till late at night and doing the work that horses usually do, pulling wagons.
And after that, where did you then move on after this place?
Okay, afterwards in January 1945, the Russian army was getting very close, so they liquidated, in other words, they made us all march in snow, deep snow, to a railway station. Then they put us into cattle cars, opened cattle cars, and then we went to a number of days from one camp to another. So there was we were in the train perhaps for the whole week. Most of those people died. For some reason, I was still alive. We got very little food. And I ended up in a camp called Flossenburg, which was in West Germany.
I can hardly imagine the horrors of facing death on a daily basis and seeing family and friends around you killed in the gas chambers. Is there anything that you can add to what you're sharing so far, just to give us a little understanding of the feeling of imminent death?
I compare this to somebody who's very ill. All you do, you want to get better. You hope to get better. You hope to survive every hour, every day. We are selfish creatures. It's terribly sad to see other people dying, but you want to preserve yourself, whether it's a nature. You just want to go on and on and on as long as you can.
John Freund, did you ever give up hope at any point when you were incarcerated there in the death camps?
It's difficult to say. That's a long time ago. And obviously I had always a little bit of strength left, so I still kept going.
My guests in studio are Shlomit Krieger, the editor of Marking Humanity, Stories, Poems, and Essays by Holocaust Survivors. And we have with us John Freund, Holocaust survivor, one of the 46 people in the book. This is Perspectives. We broadcast on Faith, Hope, and Inspire FM, Kitchener, Woodstock, and London, Ontario. My name is Barry Shanebaum. The March of the Living is an educational event that brings together thousands of Jewish youth from around the world to Poland and Israel to mark two of the most significant dates in the modern Jewish calendar. In Poland, the students' visit culminates with the March of the Living on Holocaust Remembrance Day as they march together the 3 kilometer distance separating Auschwitz from Birkenau. The students march in silent tribute to the hundreds of thousands of Jews forced by the Nazis to cross vast expanses of harsh terrain under inhumane conditions in the infamous death marches. We have here in studio the CD of Songs for March in the Living. I'm going to play a song called Ani Ma'amin. The lyrics to Ani Ma'amin were written in the 12th century by the Jewish philosopher Moses Maimonides, with the last words of hope and defiance recited by many Jews before they perished in the Holocaust. And while I play that song, if you're the first caller in here to Faith FM, and the date is November the 7th, we are repeated 1 week later in London and Woodstock, and you have not won anything on Faith FM the last 30 days, you will win the book Marking Humanity, Stories, Poems, and Essays by Holocaust Survivors, signed to you by Shlomit and by John. The studio number is 519-741-9430. That's 519-741-9430. The song is called Ani Ma'amin.
Thank you.
song is called Ani Mamin from Songs from March of the Living. Congratulations to Rebecca Hernandez. You've won the book Marking Humanity, Stories, Poems, and Essays by Holocaust Survivors. In studio, we have Shlomit Krieger, the editor of the book, and sitting right beside her is John Freund, one of the 46 survivors who lives in Toronto. John, are there any songs from those days when you were in the death camps, before or after, that have great meaning to you?
You have to understand that our background did not have Yiddish. We were Czech nationalists, so there would have been a number of songs in Czech that we sang a lot, but they would not be familiar to anybody except those who can understand or speak Czech.
Okay.
And they're not specifically Jewish.
Okay. Now, John, in the book, you have some of your poetry in the book, or your writings?
Yes.
What healing and hope and support do you get from your writing?
There's a great satisfaction in writing. I have written about the Holocaust, but I've written also about matters not connected, about the trips that I had undertaken with my family. Also wrote stories about very unusual people that I have admired, and there's a great deal of satisfaction of expressing your thoughts and hoping that somebody may read it.
How do you stay positive, or is it easy because when you've survived the Holocaust, every day is a blessing?
I'm really not looking at that. Of course, it's a blessing, and I've been extremely lucky. However, the thought of death has never left me for a second.
How many children do you have, John?
I have 3 daughters and I have 10 grandchildren.
And how old are your children?
My children? In the early 40s and mid-40s, 3 daughters.
How old were your children when you first shared with them your past and where you'd come from and what you survived and the death of all of your family?
I did talk to my children, not for a while, for a long time. I did not want the children to be affected by what had happened to me. When my middle daughter was 16, she started wondering aloud, how come all her friends have grandparents? What happened to her grandparents? So at that time, I wrote the story of my life and the Holocaust experiences. And that book was eventually published by a foundation.
Okay. And you are the author of, I'll find it right here. You are the author of 50 Years, Memories of the Birkenau Boys. In 1990, you got together with some of the survivors of the Birkenau camp?
That is correct. The Birkenau Boys, there were about, out of the original 1995, possibly half have survived. Some of them went back to their own country of origin, which was Czech. But there were also people from Holland, Germany, Austria. Most of them went back to their homes, but eventually moved to other countries, Canada, United States, Israel, Australia. And we have been contacted by one of the men who was part of this group. And he was wondering, he remembered that he was among a group of boys that were selected for life in 1944 in Birkenau. And he's starting wondering whether any of the other boys are still alive. And he found out eventually that there were about half of us alive. And we had a reunion in 1990, those who were willing to come to Israel. We had a very joyous reunion. And ever since, we have been keeping in contact. And I was my idea, and somebody said that we should write down our biographies. And so I wrote down and published this book, which I call The Memoirs of the Birkenau Boys.
John, to this very day, we have Holocaust deniers. And one of the saddest things is that the people who seem to have education, high school teachers, university professors, lawyers, and they say that while there is some deaths of some thousands of people, they deny the millions, up to 6 million Jews slaughtered, perished in the Holocaust. Does that make you feel furious or angry, or what's your thoughts when you hear about these people?
Of course, it makes me very angry. Yes, of course. I mean, there's more evidence to the Holocaust than most historical events. In fact, part of the gas chambers are still standing in Birkenau. The Germans tried to destroy them, but they were not successful. And in Birkenau, there's the crematorium, and part of the gas chambers are still standing now.
Yes. In today's Toronto Star, there's an article by Avi Ben-Lolo, who heads up the Simon Wiesenthal Center, an organization that's been involved through Simon Wiesenthal looking for Nazi collaborators. He says in his article today that while Germany has owed up to what their connection, what they did in the Holocaust, Poland has shirked a lot of its responsibility. Would you like to comment at all about Poland's responsibility, acknowledging versus Germany's responsibility for the killing?
I have no involvement with any Polish. I did not come from Poland. There were a lot of Jews in Poland. They had a rough time. But I cannot talk about the Polish Jewry because I'm not part of them.
Okay, Shlomi, can I ask that question to you about Poland taking responsibility on the record versus Germany, which has?
I think that it's important for all of the countries that were involved to stand up and take responsibility because the Holocaust was such a terrible and unique event in history, and we need to make sure that people, especially youth, are educated about it so that people don't forget what happened, and hopefully future generations can discover the true meaning of never again.
Very, very true. Now, Shlomi, during the next little while, and we will bring John back on to the interview, from the 45 other stories in the book, tell us about one of the people in the book and his or her story.
Sure. I'd like to share one of the stories from Rabbi Jacob G. Wiener. He's actually the oldest survivor featured in the book. He's now 93. Rabbi Wiener was born in Bremen, Germany in 1917 and was the eldest of four children. Following high school, he began rabbinical studies in Frankfurt am Main and later attended the Jewish Teacher Seminary in Würzburg, Bavaria. During Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass in 1938, the Nazis arrested him and held him in jail for 8 days. He returned home to discover that his mother had been murdered in their house and one of his brothers had been sent to the Sachsenhausen concentration camp. This led him to travel to Hamburg, where he found his father and a younger brother. Although anti-Semitism was on the rise, in 1939, Jacob negotiated with the Gestapo, which was the German secret state police, to allow for there to be a school for Jewish children. He was also able to sometimes obtain the release of a few Bremen Jews, especially youngsters. In May of 1939, he and his family managed to leave Germany and immigrate to Canada via Great Britain. Jacob later moved to the United States, where he earned rabbinical ordination and later also worked as a social worker. He now resides in Maryland, where he is working on his autobiography. The story that he submitted for the book is called Negotiating with the Gestapo, which is about his visits to the Gestapo office in Germany.
And you're going to read?
Yes, I'll just
please
read a few paragraphs from the story.
Please do.
Now that your government does not allow Jewish children to go to school anymore, our congregation plans to set up its own school for children, I told Mr. Parchman one day. We want to prepare the children for when they leave Germany. Mr. Parchman sneered at me. You must be daydreaming, he snickered. Do you think we will ever let you start a school where you will spread horror stories about our great nation and then tell them to the world? We are a law-abiding nation. We act according to the law, which has a stamp of our leader. We also act according to the law, our God-given law, the Torah, Jewish Bible. That's what we will teach. Mr. Parchman enjoyed baiting me and reveled in the power he possessed. Meanwhile, the German population lived in fear of the threats, terror, and intimidation that characterized Nazi policies. I continued to visit the Gestapo at the house on Am Wall. One sunny February morning, I entered the fortress-like building again with pleas for the release of three youngsters from concentration camps. I prayed that God would soften the heart of Mr. Parchman. Even Pharaoh's heart had eventually yielded to let the Jewish people leave Egypt. "Today I've had enough of you, Jewish swine," shouted Mr. Parchman. "You want those three pigs out? Out they shall go. I want all of you Jews out. It sickens the Führer, leader in this case Adolf Hitler, to have you Jews infect our pure nation." "Fine," I retorted. "Our school will help us get out." "You good for nothing," he began. I interrupted. "Would you want to feed someone unproductive? We will be preparing our children in order to be able to leave." "Do what you want," Mr. Parchman burst out. "Use the old run-down, dilapidated gym building near the river at Dyke Street." "Not in the mornings, when German youth are taught. That would be race mixing. But in the afternoon, after German school ends." "We will use it," I said. "Sign us up for it." "It's yours," he replied. "But see to it that you all scram out of Germany soon."
Thank you for that. You were listening to Shlomit Krieger reading from her book, Marking Humanity. Well, you know, let's go to one more music break. It'll be a short music break. And the singer is Megan Bochner, who was a participant in the 1990 March for the Living. The song is called Oseh Shalom. This popular Jewish refrain, which dates back to the 10th century, expresses the yearning for peace for all of Israel. Let's listen to Oseh Shalom. That's Megan Bochner singing Oseh Shalom. All programs on Perspectives are podcasts. So if you tune in tomorrow, I shouldn't say tune in to my website tomorrow, barryshanebaum.com, and click on radio. This interview is podcast. In studio, we have Shlomit Krieger, the editor of Marking Humanity, Stories, Poems, and Essays by Holocaust Survivor, and John Freund, who is a Holocaust survivor. Shlomit, why don't we have you share another story?
The next one is by Anne Kind. Anne was born Anneliese Rosenberg in Berlin, Germany in 1922. In 1934, a year after Hitler came to power in Germany, she fled to England with her parents. She went on to later study nursing and married a doctor. Over the years, she has also worked as an administrator for the Family Planning Association and as an administrator and fundraiser for the La Roche Leicestershire and Rutland Hospice. Anne is also an accomplished creative writer. Her poetry has appeared in such literary journals as Stan Magazine, New Hope International, Staple, Iota, and North Words, as well as in poetry anthologies. In 1994, Volcano Press Limited published a biography she wrote on Leicestershire naturalist Jack Otter titled Come and See This, Folks. I'll read one of Anne's poems in the book. It's about Anne speaking with a woman who had been a member of the Hitler Youth during the Holocaust. Her poem is titled Role Reversal. Gisela, you were a leader in the Hitler Youth. You didn't see much wrong with him, were told to hate, and meekly you obeyed. But that was 40 years ago. You, dear, and I were children then. Come, let us talk, you said. Sit over here. It's cozy in that corner. Let's begin. At that point, I recalled the poison showers. You'd never heard of them. Why did you leave the fatherland, you asked. Insensitive, I thought. Shan't drop my mask. The situation is grotesque. If any of my kinsfolk saw me here, they'd feel betrayed, although you appear sincere. Poor Gisela, you wanted a response from me. I cannot even hate you, dear.
Thank you. And let's go into another story from your book.
Sure. I have a story by Fred Ambi Ambram.
Okay.
He spent his early childhood years in Hanover, Germany, where he experienced Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass, and the aftermath.
Can you explain what is Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass?
Sure. That's the night in November 1938 when synagogues and other places were burned and looted, and it happened from November 9th to the 10th.
And who was doing the burning and the breaking of the glass?
Oh, the Hitler Youth and the Nazi people, the officers in those areas.
In which countries?
It was in Germany.
In Germany.
And the loss of uncles, aunts, and grandmother, and many other relatives motivated Fred to prepare a detailed family tree. The loss of his only cousin, who was murdered in Auschwitz-Birkenau at the age of 3.5, continues to haunt him. Fred is now a retired professor of communication and creativity at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, United States. He has relayed his Holocaust stories to his children and grandchildren, and he and his entire family are working to help put an end to genocide everywhere. Fred is also the author of several books and numerous book chapters, articles, and stories. He is currently working on a memoir and a novel. I'll share a bit from Fred's story about how his father helped to hide the Torah, Jewish Bible, during the night of Kristallnacht. His story is titled Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. Papa missed supper. When he finally came home, he reported that he had not been with the Christians downstairs. He was carrying a huge bundle covered with large rags and blankets. Was it a body? When the wrappings were removed, I could see that they had sheltered a Torah, Jewish Bible, almost as big as my papa. He had rescued the Holy Scroll from our local synagogue while the building was aflame. Muti, my mother, scolded him. Why take the risk? One should take precautions. And why bring a Torah into an apartment when even radios are forbidden? Radios! I remember when the Gestapo came to all Jewish homes hunting for radios. The men in shiny black boots searched every room. Radios were verboten. Contact with the outside world was forbidden. I remember feeling like the man of the house while Papa was away on business. I was, in fact, a frightened little boy. I didn't know if I cried or not, but I did stand in front of my mother, not behind. Why bring a Torah into an apartment where even radios are forbidden? Muti asked again. A meaningful question. A full-sized Torah on the fourth floor of an apartment building would put all of the residents at risk. Hero was not a word that entered the evening's conversation. I didn't hear talk of Hero until years later, when we were safely settled in the United States. Papa had no plan for the Torah. The rabbi would know what to do. Wait until nightfall.
Thank you. You're listening to Shlomi Krieger reading from her book, Marking Humanity, Stories, Poems, and Essays by Holocaust Survivors, the mass slaughter in Rwanda and Sudan and other places. And sometimes they use the word Holocaust. Looking back at the horrors of the Jewish Holocaust, what can we do to ensure, with the hate mongers around the world and some in high positions of political office, how can we stop any slide towards mass slaughter again, in this case of the Jews? And what's the canary in the birdcage, Shlomi?
Well, I think that, in my intro for the book, I also touch upon
how several of the issues that arose during the Holocaust are still relevant in people's own communities today. The types of acts that are carried out now may be carried out in different ways, but the basic issues are still relevant. For example, there's hatred, discrimination, violence. It's very much ongoing. And even something like bullying is a major issue in many communities today. I had a friend in elementary school who was bullied a lot, and she ended up becoming suicidal. So I think it's very important that we educate all people to take responsibility for their actions and to know that they have consequences. And that also they can work on becoming more conscious of their emotions and thoughts and better assess how they would want to respond to their life experiences, because it's very easy to resort to wanting to hurt people or take away from them, and it takes a lot to rise above that.
And right now, with the president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, those who have translated his words say that he has said that Israel should be wiped off the map. Others say he hasn't quite said those words. What is your personal view on the president of Iran? How dangerous is he and the country of threatening to bomb Israel out of existence?
I think it's a very major threat that we have today, and we definitely need to respond to it in some way.
What do you think is the answer? Israel has made noises that they may strike Iran. The U.S. says if Iran is attacked, if Israel is attacked, the U.S. will attack. Others say that Ahmadinejad is just a vile, evil man, but the mullahs in control of Iran are smart enough people. They know it would be major destruction for their country. Any more thoughts on the president of Iran and his hateful ramblings towards Israel?
I think that in some way it's a reflection of what happened during the Holocaust. It's kind of another Hitler coming up in this world, and we need to, I'm not exactly sure the best way to respond, but
true,
it is important to take consideration of what's going on. For example, according to the 2009 audit of anti-Semitic incidents released by the League for Human Rights of B'nai B'rith Canada in 2010, 1,264 incidents from across Canada alone were reported to the League that year. That's close to a fivefold increase in a decade. So anti-Semitism is still very much an ongoing issue, and it is a threat from Iran to Israel and also around the world.
True. And as far as Iran, countries that are supplying technology and parts to Iran, it could be so simple as them choosing not to do it. But that's getting into politics also.
Yes.
So John, you survived the horrors of the Holocaust. You lost your family. When you listen to incidences of anti-Semitism is rising, well, an upcoming guest in my show who's a professor based in Toronto says that the reports of anti-Semitism are overblown. Do you ever fear that a Holocaust event could happen again and the Jewish people would suffer again?
Of course I do. I'm personally not involved now because I'm old enough, but I do have family, I have children, I have grandchildren, and hope will be great-grandchildren, so of course I am concerned. I feel we live in one of the best countries in the world. I think that we are probably safer here than most other countries in the world. But, of course, there is a fear of that happening again in Canada or all over the world. And the world is very violent, and it does not look very prosperous in the future.
So, John, in your opinion, at what point should Israel or the states consider acting militarily if Iran continues and gets a bomb? Now, they would have one bomb. Israel is allegedly to have over 200. Bombing another country could start Third World War. Do you have any comments on the present situation, particularly with Iran?
I of course, I have many thoughts about it. Well, you cannot believe everything you read in the newspaper or the opinions. Of course, it's very dangerous. I have no suggestion when to attack or whether attack. Any war that would come would be 10 times as bad as any previous wars, and the whole world could be destroyed. So,
Okay. John, we have a few minutes left for Shlomit and John. So, John, how long have you lived in Toronto?
I was one of the Jewish orphans that was permitted to come to Canada in 1948, that's a long time ago. I was 18 years old when I came. I was brought in. The Jewish Congress paid for my travel expenses. I started working as a busboy in a donut place in Toronto. And then with the help of the Jewish authorities, I was able to finish high school, after which I went into an accounting course. I became a chartered accountant, and I worked for a government department for the rest of my working time.
John Freund, all these years in Toronto, rebuilding your life, starting a family, and now you're a grandfather. Do you ever suffer this new term of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder? Do you ever wake up in the middle of the night in a bad dream, like you're back in Birkenau?
As I told you before, this fear has never left me for a second.
How do you deal with the fact this fear has never left you for a second? Do you just put it out of your mind because you have to, or...?
Well, I mean, I'm quite busy with things, and I'm quite active. I like to speak to people. I have a number of friends. I'm also doing volunteer work in various organizations, Jewish and non-Jewish, and I enjoy doing that. So there's a lot. I'm quite busy occupying my mind and my body.
You sound very alive. Tell us a bit about your volunteer work.
My volunteer work, well, this morning I was a volunteer at the Holy Blossom Temple where we prepare breakfast for interested people. Then we have a lecture. I've spent many years as a volunteer for the Canadian Opera Company. I always loved opera, so I was a volunteer for them for about 20 years. I was honored in the province of Ontario grouping. So those would be my major occupation, but I also have friends in all sorts of connections, Jewish and non-Jewish. I've been quite busy. If I'm asked to go to a high school to talk, there's one particular book that was published about my childhood called The Underground Reporters. It's written by Kathy Kaser, which is a lovely book for children. Occasionally, I go with the author, Kathy Kaser, to a school, public school, high school, and we talk about that. So that's also, and also I have been doing some of my own writing, but this is just self-published.
John, if any of our listeners today, say, teach in schools or work in different organizations, and they want to contact you to invite you to speak and hopefully pay you something, do you have an email address, or should we go through Shlomit's email address if they wish to contact you?
Yes, I do have an email address. I'm not sure whether I should publicize this. This is a fairly, but I'm in the telephone book. My name is John Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D. So anybody who wishes to contact me, I live in Toronto. There's only one John Freund in the telephone book. So they can contact me, but I don't like to pass my email address because various reasons. All my friends do have it, and anybody interested can certainly get it.
Well, John Freund, from what I see of you in your life, it's a testament to hope over fear, to love over hate, and basically to persistence and tenacity. Any final words from you before I say thank you to Shlomit and wrap up in a few minutes with Shlomit?
I met Shlomit only half a year ago or so, perhaps a little bit longer. I think she's quite a courageous woman. She contacted a lot of people all over the world, and her book is I read through it very recently. It's a very good document, and she published one of my stories which was probably the worst event that I ever witnessed. In Birkenau, where two men tried to escape and they were caught, and the mistreatment was so incredibly cruel that even I cannot get that out of my head. They were just mistreated terribly, and then they were hung publicly.
Well, Mr. John Freund, thank you very much for coming into the station today. It's an honor to meet you, and continued good health and success to you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Shlomi, you've created a fabulous book, Marking Humanity, Stories, Poems, and Essays by Holocaust Survivors. Well, first of all, we're going to repeat it at least twice. Where can people pick up a copy of your book?
They can find it on Amazon, Chapters Indigo, and other online retailer websites. They can go to www.soulinscriptionspress.com, and they can find a listing of different places where they can get it and also have a way to contact me or the publishing company for more information.
After creating this book, are you more hopeful for the future or less hopeful or somewhere in the middle?
That's a good question. I would say that there is a lot of work left to do for humanity. It involves every single person around the world taking responsibility for who they are. We all need to work on bettering ourselves and helping to care for the world around us. And with this book, I not only wanted it to celebrate the indomitable spirits of the Holocaust survivors, but also I feel it could serve as a good example for other people around the world who are still struggling to be heard and to reach a place of love, peace, and healing.
Thank you, Shlomi. And I want to let our listeners know that off camera or off mic is your father, Gedalia, a proud father taking some pictures. And Gedalia, thank you for coming into the station also today here at Faith FM. So John and Shlomi, thank you very much to both of you.
Thank you very much
success and continue writing and continue making a difference.
Thank you for having us here.
Our pleasure. And Shlomi, give out your website one more time for your book, Marking Humanity, and where people can pick it up.
Sure, it's www.soulinscriptionspress.com. And again, it's available on Amazon, Indigo Chapters, and other online retailers.
Great. Thank you very much. This is Perspectives. We broadcast on Faith, Hope, and Inspire FM, Kitchener, Woodstock, in London, Ontario. My name is Barry Shanebaum. This program is podcast on my website tomorrow, www.barryshanebaum.com. Click on radio. We're going to play a song called We Rise Again. We Rise Again was a popular song among Canadian participants in the 1994 March of the Living. The song is performed by three participants, all from Halifax, Nova Scotia. We Rise Again.
As sure as the sun rises, as sure as the sun.
Thank you again to Shlomi Krieger, the editor of Marking Humanity, Stories, Poems, and Essays by Holocaust Survivors, and Mr. John Freund. A pleasure to meet you, John, one of the survivors in the book of 46 survivors honored by Shlomi Krieger. Hope you can tune in next week. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Perspectives with your host, Barry Shanebaum. Join us next week for Perspectives on Faith FM and Hope FM, 94.3 in Kitchener and Woodstock, and on Inspire FM, 105.9 in London, Ontario.